This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion on duality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Larry Wilson, who is pastor of the First Mennonite Church in Urbana. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you very much.
We're going to be talking about Mennonite faith and life and experience. Were you raised Mennonite, or did you come to this from somewhere else?
I was raised Mennonite. My father was Scotch-Irish, not particularly from a religious background, but married a Mennonite woman. And I don't know this officially, but I think maybe part of the contract was that he would also join church. And so I, from the little on up, I was part of a Mennonite church about an hour and 50 minutes north of here.
And what town was that?
A small town called Meadows. It's about 40 miles east of Peoria.
Okay. This church, a Baptist church, mm-hmm. perhaps a Catholic church, but not always a Mennonite church. How widespread are Mennonites? How many Mennonites are there?
How many Mennonites are there? In this area, there's not a lot. In the Champaign-Urbana area, we are the only congregation in town. Mm-hmm. If you would go south to Arthur or north to Fisher, there are a couple of Mennonite congregations. Probably 12,000 or so in Illinois and several hundred thousand in terms of the United States. Worldwide, the Anabaptist Mennonite grouping, there's about 1 million people. But a lot right now, there are more Mennonites in South America and or Africa than there are in Europe, which is where Mennonites started, and or with the United States.
And so that's because of the missionary movement?
From the missionary movement, right. Uh-huh. And very, very strong congregations.
Now, when you count Mennonites and Anabaptists, and we'll get to that word in a minute, mm-hmm. but does that include the Amish?
Yes, it does.
It would?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so let's talk about Anabaptist. Okay. What is that?
Well, Anabaptist means rebaptizers, I guess, from the 1500. It's not anti-baptism, but in the 1500s, early 1500s, there was more state churches in Europe, in Switzerland and Germany, and a number of young radicals, I would guess, in their young life, late 20s, early 30s, as they were doing Bible study with a man named Ulrich Zwingli in Zurich, Switzerland, came to the conclusion that they thought that the examples given in the New Testament were more oriented toward believers. It was a missionary book. And so they felt like that's what they wanted to do. So they refused to have their children baptized. But that created not only—
As infants.
As infants.
Uh-huh. Right.
But that created all waves, not only in the state churches, but also with the governing bodies, because that was also the tax record. And so it seemed like it was also anti—
Government.
Government and anti-church.
Anti-country, yeah.
Yeah. And so this was not a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, that tradition, though, of questioning that tradition of, I don't know how to put it, but sort of being set apart from the government, that continues to be a Mennonite and Amish tradition, doesn't it?
It takes two different expressions. I think the Amish tend not to speak to government per se or question some of those things. They choose to say, they make our statement, their statement by their lifestyle and having more communities, and that's how they make their statement, saying we're not really a part of the world, even though there are aspects that they do choose. But the technology they use, they try not to have it control them, but they try to use it in ways that they choose to have it controlled, and oftentimes a bit later than most other people do. Mennonites are, we've kind of mainstreamed in many, many ways, particularly as more acceptance has come here in the States. And but there's still a strong awareness that being Christian and being a citizen are two different realities, no matter what country you live in, whether it's the United States or some other place.
Now, Mennonites, although they're a very relatively small part of the Protestant Christian tradition in this country, mm-hmm. are kind of well known, partly because of some stands they've taken, though, particularly in relation to peace, mm-hmm. in relation to conscientious objection during times of war, resisting mm-hmm. the draft when there was a draft. Mm-hmm. How is that part of the tradition?
Yeah. Peace has always been part of the tradition. They felt like that the Sermon on the Mount, and when Jesus says to love your enemies, they took that in very literal kinds of ways. And so they didn't. We don't feel like it's being true to what Jesus was teaching to say, okay, when you wear a uniform or a part of the state, an army, that it's okay to kill, but when you are a private citizen, you can't. And so they say, we feel like our witness is, this is not just, you can't separate those two. You are one person. And so what you do, no matter who you're doing it for, is how you're responding to the New Testament teaching of love your enemies. And we don't see how we can say, I love you, but I'm sorry, you have to be eliminated. And so mm-hmm. that creates the conscience part that mm-hmm. we struggle with.
Now, you and I are about the same age. We were discussing before we went on the air. Mm-hmm. And we went to the same college, mm-hmm. which required ROTC at right. the time you and I were in school. And the Vietnam War was going on. Yeah. How did you, as a Mennonite mm-hmm. young adult in college, when there was a draft and a war, how did you deal with that?
That was a hard one for me, Steve, because my father, because he was not raised Mennonite, had some questions about the integrity of that position. Mm. And he said, you know, if you live it not just during wartime, but you live it all the time, he said, I can respect that. Mm. But if it's just an out, he said, I don't believe in that. So I knew I wanted to be a pastor or minister. So I thought there'd probably be a deferment somewhere out there. Huh. And so I signed up and took the required ROTC kind of thing. And I lasted about 3 weeks. And I couldn't eat and I couldn't sleep.
Really?
And all that I had come to believe through Sunday school and church and how I read the New Testament and what I'd come to believe just didn't jive with that. Hmm. It didn't help that the class I had before ROTC was a Bible class where the professor had been a former missionary to Burma and would weep in class about all the folks who didn't know the gospel. And then I got to ROTC class, and the instructor said, okay, now I know all you young men have been raised in, a lot of you have been raised in churches and so on, but this is the army, mm-hmm. and there's a different reality here you have to learn to live with. And then with some of the films that were shown, emphasizing that in that time the Viet Cong were not really people, that's the enemy. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't make that jump from who is the enemy and who is the one that is struggling out there that we ought to be trying to work with. I went to the dean at that point in time and said, I can't do this. Uh-huh. And this was probably not one of his better moments either, but he gave me a 20-minute lecture on Christian patriotism.
I see.
And that it was our duty. And but after seeing that I was rather adamant about this, with a letter from my home pastor, and I was excused. And so I only had my gun and uniform and boots for about the 3 weeks.
So you never had to go to summer camp and learn that the spirit of the bayonet is kill.
No. Yeah. So that was hard, but because as an 18-year-old boy, mm-hmm. too, or a young man, I was struggling with what does it mean to be a man. Mm-hmm. And so when, you know, somebody who I respected and the school where I was going was saying, you know, this is Christian patriotism, and yet I couldn't do that, what does that say about me as a person? And so that was a hard time.
Right. And that puts you apart from a lot of your peers in college at that time, at that Christian college, where there was a great commitment to Christian patriotism as that dean defined it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define Christian patriotism today?
Yeah, I feel like that I am patriotic. I do love my country. Been out of the country a couple times in the last couple years, and flying back in, I'm very grateful to live where I live.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grateful for the freedoms. And so I think the patriotism that I would sense is that I want to support and encourage all the good things that my government does.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many places where that could be enhanced or altered that wouldn't just benefit us, that it might be a bit broader. And I know we do some of those things, but it seems like there are there are other places where justice could be more fairly defined and worked at. And so I think part of what I see patriotism is to also hold the mirror and to raise the questions. I don't have all the answers, mm-hmm. but at least raise some questions mm-hmm. and pray for my leaders. And I vote. Mm-hmm. Some Mennonites don't because they're not sure there's that big a choice between who's leading, whether it's Democrat or Republican. Others feel very passionately about one side or the other. Uh-huh. And there are Mennonites who are Republicans and Mennonites who are Democrats. Uh-huh.
But your final commitment isn't to the particular nation in which you live.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's one of the struggles, I guess, I had at Wheaton, and mm-hmm. and I couldn't quite identify that as what was going on, but it felt like it was God and country were the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I knew enough history to realize that countries do come and go.
Yes.
And I hope ours will go on for a long, long time. But nations do come and go, and God there's a difference between God and country.
Mm-hmm. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon on this live program on WILL. We're talking with Larry Wilson, who is pastor of the First Mennonite Church in Urbana. And this is a live call-in show, and we're eager to have people join the conversation. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, there are several local lines you can access by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. Elsewhere, there's a toll-free line you can access by punching in 1-800-222-9455. So we're happy to have callers ask questions or make comments to our guest. I mentioned this is WILL, a broadcasting service at the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. And we do have our first caller on line 4. Where are you calling from, please, if you don't mind?
I'm calling from Eureka.
Great.
Your guest raised a very interesting question. I, too, am Mennonite. I remember going to Goshen College in the late 1960s, and I remember a nearby college, Grace, which is, I believe, run by the Grace Brethren. And the sense I got at that time, and this is not an easy struggle, but many of the so-called Christian groups, evangelical groups, and he talked about God and country, were far more militaristic than, say, the secular society around us. And I remember a specific picture in the South Bend Tribune about some students at Grace College that were very gung-ho about the Vietnam War. My question to your guest is, it seems to me that we still get this Constantinian mix-up that somehow that the state is Christian and it acts in that realm, whereas I think the contribution the Anabaptists made is that they really questioned a follower of Christ acting upon violence based upon the Sermon on the Mount and many of the others of Jesus' teachings. I wonder what your guest would respond to that.
Thank you for the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with you, I guess, in much of what you said. I think that whenever one mixes politics and faith in a very fervent kind of way, it's very hard to keep them teased apart, and I suppose all of us have trouble doing that.
And I know when I was at the same college you went to, Wheaton College up near Chicago, I was fortunate in that I didn't have to personally make that choice at that point. ROTC was required, but not for people who were below or above a certain height.
Oh, okay.
And the uniforms wouldn't fit. You know, you couldn't fit on the beds or whatever. And I was 1/4 inch too tall. At the time, I was 6'8 1/4", and the limit was 6'8". Now, later in the Vietnam War, when they were trying to get more and more people, they took away those things. But by mm-hmm. then, I was in seminary, and I had another
interesting
deferment. But
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But
I know the mood at the time at Wheaton, when the caller referred to militaristic evangelicals. I mean, we would hear talks frequently in the required chapels mm-hmm. that were there Monday through Friday in those days for half an hour every day, often from people who really said, you know, if our country's at war, then we as Christians should be supporting it.
Yeah.
But there were Christians sitting in that mm-hmm. congregation like you who said, no, wait, that doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Years later, when I talked to some of the administration persons that I had known earlier, and faculty persons, they said that a lot of that has changed in the college in these days, that there's much more awareness and appreciation of differing points of view. That certainly was the mood in the 60s when we were there.
Now, how does that affect your ministry today as a pastor of a Mennonite church? Mm-hmm. You're, what, the closest Christian church to the mosque here in Champaign-Urbana for where Muslims worship. How does your idea of Christianity today fit with the current world situation?
It's very hard for me sometimes when I hear politicians and or religious leaders talk about God being on our side, and that God is blessing our efforts no matter what we do. How that impacts me in terms of the mosque and our Muslim neighbors, which are a block away from us, is that I've been invited to speak at some of their panels or forums on occasion, and also we try to provide another face to what the Christian church and Jesus also is about. I think that's particularly important in these days because, for example, at the mosque, I don't know how many countries represented, but 16 or 20 different countries, and these are going to be future leaders there. And for them to hear a Christian pastor who says, no, Jesus does teach us the way of peace, and this is important, and not all churches and Christians are in agreement that war is the way to solve the problems in the Middle East or any place else. They have not heard that before. Mm-hmm. And so that's at least one contribution we're trying to make in terms of that area.
We have another caller waiting on one of the local lines. Let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes. The previous caller used an expression, post-Constantinian, I believe, and I was wondering if that could be explained a little bit further. And also, I'm just wondering, I only have a vague idea of what the Mennonites believe about, the Roman Empire versus the church and the relationship or lack of relationship between the two. And then I'm just wondering your view of, say, American culture, and is it, can we say that if we were just to get better and more holy than more godly, then we would have the right to spread our culture and our materialist approach to, not our materialist approach to life, but we have to spread that in a materialist way, some people might believe. And also then, what do you think about discourses that use the Bible or, even the Roman Empire? I've heard people talking about, what we're doing in Iraq, or I've read an article in the New Republic by a neoconservative ideologue comparing the way they wanted to revise the military to the Roman Empire. And what do you think about the use of these discourses in politics?
Thank you. We'll let our guest make a start at that. And let me encourage other callers, if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, 1-800-222-9455 is a free call from anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet. In Champaign-Urbana, several lines are available, 333-9455. So, Larry, let's first start with that term that an earlier caller used, post-Constantinian.
Okay. My understanding is that prior to Constantine, which was in about the 300s sometime, I don't recall the exact date, that the church was suspect and it was not accepted in the Roman Empire. But after Constantine's had some kind of an experience that was connected with a military victory that he had, that he accepted Christianity as being a good thing, and as that acceptance happened, it seemed like something happened in the church as well.
And it became the official religion of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, it helped hold things together in many ways, and it's very, very important. But many people, at least I should say that a number of folks, sometimes wonder whether that was not the downfall of the church, because we became government
establishment.
Yeah, very much so. So post-Constantinian means that whatever's happened in terms of identifying God and country, or becoming the official religion of a given country, no matter where it's at, Europe or here, is not always a good thing. If American culture got better, would that be something we'd want to spread around the world? Not necessarily. I don't equate American culture with Christian faith either. Christianity has many expressions, and whether it's in Zimbabwe or Colombia or in some place in some other place, there's going to be cultural expressions of that which have integrity. And I think many of us wonder about some of the materialism or the commercialism of our own culture and don't equate that with Christianity, even though that's hard to distinguish because we're all caught up in it in various ways. There's none of us that are pure on that one. I forgot what the third part was.
The last question she had was about the Bible use by some ideologues the way that they interpret the Bible may be very different from the way you do, it sounded like.
Well, I think that's always the case. I mean, there's going to be people who look at the Scriptures in different ways. Even as I read the New Testament, I sense there's some dialogue and conversation going on even among the gospel writers and the other letters, not necessarily fighting with each other, but trying to clarify. And they look at things in a slightly different way and tell the story slightly differently. And so I, as a Mennonite, might find myself honing in on the Sermon on the Mount and other places like that might lead me toward the direction I'm going, whereas other folks might hone in on some other parts of the New Testament that also are there. And I don't always know what to do with those, just like other churches or pastors may not know what to do with some of the things I've honed in on. So I think that's why in many ways we need each other to keep holding the mirror for each other to when we have our own perspectives that are maybe God-given and helpful for us to emphasize, but it's not the only corner on truth.
Thank you. And we have another caller waiting, again on a local line, Line 1. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Larry Wilson. Go ahead, please.
Yes. I have three questions. When I was little, I'm 68 years old, and when I was little, I used to read the Sermon on the Mount to one of the boys, and he said, "Mom, that's beautiful poetry, but the real world doesn't work that way." And I'm very
turning the other cheek and all that.
Yes,
yes,
exactly.
All right.
I'm very nonviolent myself. I wondered also how you reconcile that question with 911, the whole thing about being attacked and how patriotic you should be. Anyhow, I'm sort of confused. And then I saw the spirit of the Olympics, and that was a wonderful spirit, but different countries and everybody yo-ho for their own country. And so I'm sort of confused, and I want to see if Larry can help me out with answers. And I'll hang up and listen to your response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. So the first question was about the Sermon on the Mount. Is this poetry, or is this real-world practical advice?
I would say it's real-world practical advice. I know that there are some groups who say that it's so idealistic that it's going to be put off until an end time or it's just poetry, and I don't think that's true. That doesn't make it any easier to know how to live. In my sermon this morning, I just commented that sometimes Jesus said some things that he put out there and then kind of let his audience stew about it. What does this mean? Hmm. How do I interpret that? And in some ways, the Sermon on the Mount is one of those things that I think if one lives with that very long, it creates a lot of discomfort in me, at least, and I think in most of us. How do I actually live that out? And there are days when I think, I think I measured up to that part, and the next day I totally blow it. And so when your son said it's not the real world, well, it's not the world we live in, but maybe it's more of a real world that God intends for us than what our so-called real world is that we actually do occupy historical space in.
And her second question, the caller's second question, was about the terrorist attack of 9/11. What do you think about self-defense? And do nations have the right to defend themselves in spite of the your interpretation of Jesus' commandments on the Sermon on the Mount?
Yeah, that's really a hard one. I think part of nations' roles includes the government and roles would be to protect its citizens and to try to promote the good. What happened at 9/11 was certainly not a good, it was a very evil kind of thing. How we reacted to that and what we chose to do about that may not have been much better, but that's Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, people were making some very difficult choices at the time. I often wonder what would have happened before 9/11 and consequently if we would have had another approach and said, what is creating this and how can we jointly resolve some of the tensions in our world in terms of the multinational corporations or are trying to take your resources so we can have a better life? What can we do to help your people and you? Now, if they're primarily evil leaders doing these things, then reason doesn't work very well. Mm-hmm. And then I'm not sure where one goes. Mm-hmm. I thought was being pretty reasonable along the way, but he also got hung on a cross. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't always work, but it still might mean that as an individual believer, and I don't know exactly how to apply this to government, but I don't know that individual believers can necessarily respond selectively. For me personally, I could not kill anybody. I would hope that I'd be able to find some way to, if necessary, defend my family or other persons, but hopefully not to do it in a way that would take another person's life, because then I am doing the very thing to them that I feel like is what I believe to be morally wrong. It's not my right to do.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Reverend Larry Wilson, who is pastor of the First Mennonite Church of Urbana. Tell the location of your church, Larry.
Yeah, we're on the corner of Lincoln and Springfield in Urbana.
How long has the congregation been there?
We've been at that particular location about 12 years. It used to be a Free Methodist congregation, and we were just down the street on Springfield about a block.
How long has the congregation been in Champaign-Urbana?
Since the mid-60s.
Okay. So
relatively new.
Relatively recent.
Yeah.
We have another caller on line one. Let's go to that line. You're on the air with Larry Wilson. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask Larry Wilson how he feels about the United Nations helping the world get more in an orderly, responsive mix. Mm-hmm. Just like we praise the United States so much, but the United Nations is just starting on the same way to give all the people of the world some chance to take care of their affairs but be part of the whole. And what does he think about the United Nations being given more help to do this?
Well, I personally feel like the United Nations has a very important role. And in our kind of a world, any way we can find ways of doing things cooperatively and having the assistance of other people seems to me to make a whole lot of sense. I would be most comfortable if the United Nations works primarily in peacekeeping kind of roles and trying to do as much as possible to operate more like a police force rather than begin to attack other places. And I don't see that on their agenda at this point in time. But here again, for me to be totally consistent, to say, well, I'm for United Nations armed forces is not very consistent either. But in our kind of a world, I think there are some places where restraint of evil is important to do. And the United Nations seems to be a better place to do that, and it would seem like that would be money well spent from the United States as long as we weren't trying to pull the strings on how exactly it's being spent. It's just a personal opinion on that.
We're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program this Sunday afternoon. This is a live program produced and provided by the WILL AM, AM 580, a broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for the program. We'll continue our conversation with Larry Wilson in a few moments and include other calls. Let me tell listeners who's coming up in future programs. Next week, Don Mason, pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Urbana, will be our guest, and he'll be talking primarily about his recent visit in Africa as a delegate to the World Alliance of Reformed Churches. That'll be September 5th here on Keeping the Faith. September 12th, we'll be talking with Mary Joy Carnate and Claire Delahunt about their experience as tutors in the local schools through a program called Vis-a-Vis. This is a program that takes college students at the university and places them in elementary schools, and middle schools, and high schools in a one-to-one tutoring relationship with students or as teachers' aides. So we'll be learning about that September 12th here on Keeping the Faith. And then on September 19th, we'll be hearing from Tammy Lemke, Executive Director of the CEO of the United Way of Champaign County, and Dan Wheatman, who is the President of the Board currently of United Way, about the programs and plans for United Way here in the area. So those are some of the programs that are coming up in the weeks ahead. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest continuous student organization on the campus. It was started by students in 1873, and since that time has been providing opportunities for community service and social action for students, and programs also for faculty and staff. Coming up at the Y this fall, September 14, will be our first Know Your University program at noon, a free lecture by the interim chancellor of the university, Richard Herman. He's been the provost, and since Nancy Cantor's moving on, is now the interim chancellor. So he'll be talking about looking to the future for the university. Other programs in the Know Your University series will have a musical program September 21 at noon. And all of these are free, of course, and people can bring their lunch or can buy lunch at the Wai Thai restaurant with good food from Thailand. Robert McChesney will be our guest September 28th, talking about the problem of the media. And we have another musical program October 12th with Scott Swartz, talking about John Philip Sousa. Friday Forums also start soon, September 17, Friday at noon. Susan Thistlethwaite, who is president of the Chicago Theological Seminary, will be talking about Christian conflict resolution. That's September 17 at the University Y. Bruce Williams from the Institute of Communications at the university will be talking about the toll on democracy that happens with war rhetoric. That's September 24. And Ibu Patel, executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps, will be speaking October 1st at the Y, Interfaith Relations. All those programs are at noon and are free and open to the public. Something particularly for students at the university happens this week, Wednesday, September 1st. There'll be an introductory information meeting about the possibility of going to Jerusalem to explore the holy sites of Christians, Muslims, and Jews that are found in that part of Israel, that part of Palestine. And students who are interested in going on a trip to see those holy sites January 3 through 16 in 2005 are invited to come to that information meeting. It'll be at 8:30 at night at Gregg Hall, room 100. That's Wednesday, September 1st, 8:30 p.m. in Gregory Hall, room 100, an information meeting for those who might be interested in going on a interfaith trip to Jerusalem, a Holy Land journey, January 3 through 16. Communiversity, another program of the University Y, is starting up soon. Classes on ballroom dance. Classes start September 13, and then the second session begins October 18. There's also non-ballroom dance, hip-hop, beginning jazz, capoeira, I think it's pronounced, Afro-Brazilian dance, martial art combination. Classes available in that. Yoga, Tai Bo, Pilates, massage, how to learn how to give your friends a neck, head, and face massage or foot massage, other things. Clark Brooks is teaching classes in photography again. Karate for Kids, The Artist's Way, all kinds of classes available. Please check the Y website or pick up a catalog at the University Y or at other places around campus. The University Y website is universityymca.org, and then look at Communiversity. And there will be a class for those interested in this trip to Jerusalem. They'll start September 13. Programs that people who like keeping the faith topics might want to hear on Focus 580 this week, Tuesday, the 8th of September, The Jew in Cinema. That'll be presented by Omer Bartoff, who is a distinguished professor at Brown University. That's Tuesday at 10 o'clock with David Inge on Focus 580 here on WILL. And on Wednesday, the very next day, Notre Dame versus the Klan, How the Fighting Irish Defeated the Ku Klux Klan. Todd Tucker, a writer, will be on the air at 11 o'clock on Focus 580 this Wednesday. I want to thank many people in the community for helping the WISE Big Dump and Run program, which ended yesterday, thankfully. It ended, I say thankfully, because we're all very tired who participated in it, the staff and volunteers. It was a huge program, but many students and other people who particularly needed some things cheaply were able to buy them at a huge garage sale at the Stock Pavilion. We thank the university for its cooperation. The Office of International Student Affairs that co-sponsored the sale. Many international students furnished whole apartments for often less than $100. So we thank the people who donated items. We thank all the volunteers who helped us pack it away in semi-trailers and then unload them. Particular thanks to young men from Lincoln's Challenge program in Rantoul who came and did community service by unloading those trucks and helping us organize the materials. So we had a grand four-day sale. It kept a lot of things out of the waste stream and gave a lot of people bargains and provided some much-needed financial support to the University YMCA. So, again, thanks to all the people who contributed. At this point, we're not accepting any items for future dump and runs. That may happen later, but at the moment, we will accept, again, donated cars, automobiles, pickup trucks, but that's it. Well, to get back into talking with Larry Wilson about Mennonite faith and life, I want to read a poem again that might get us into a interesting topic, and then I see we have another caller waiting. I'll get to that as quickly as possible. But first, this poem called Chaplain. It's a poem about suffering, and I want to talk about particularly the kind of suffering that minority religions like the Amish and the Mennonites have suffered over the years. But here's a poem called Chaplain, dealing with the silent film star Charlie Chaplin. This was published first in Image, a journal of religion and the arts, and published most recently by University of Illinois Press, a book called A Deed to the Light. The poet is Jean Murray Walker. Chaplain. Maybe suffering is always like this, as black and white and silent as the little man pacing his jail cell, his suit suddenly grown too tight, his hands gripping the cold bars while he cranes his neck to see whether his beautiful woman still waits for him at the table set in their shack. There's no jailer, that's how it is. Or else the jailer gives him a look as if to say, "You put yourself in here, Buster, now find your own way out." This funny crumbsuck of a man, no Robert Redford, I can tell you, more like a heart on legs. When we see a close-up of the girl, her pointy lips and white catastrophic face, we guess that she won't spring him, and even with all our longing, we can't. We who are prisoners in our own lives, their iron gates unlocking only rarely, for instance, the way some technician learned to transfer old film to this video so we can watch the little man's heart break. The way my friends did, for example, slowing her dead lover's last message on the answering machine, dwelling on each grainy vowel until her possibilities seemed as small as chaplains in his cell. A poem called Chaplain, included in a recent book, A Deed to the Light, by Jean Murray Walker, published by University of Illinois Press. Well, we'll talk about suffering, but before we do that, we won't let our caller keep suffering by waiting any longer. On line four, go ahead, please. Yes, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm not suffering.
Okay.
So far, I have three questions. The first of which is, what is the relationship that y'all have with Holy Spirit?
You want to clarify that a little bit, expand on that question?
Well, Unitarians, for example, don't believe in the dogma of a Trinitarian movement.
Okay.
I'm so ignorant of what
Mennonites believe. Yeah, all right, fine. Okay, we'll ask that question, and you had a couple others.
Yes, my second one is there, can you give me in broad strokes a idea of the prayer life of the group of people that you're affiliated with?
Okay.
And my third question regards the attitude of earth stewardship.
Earth stewardship.
Yeah, this is a topic that Wendell Berry and more particular Matthew Fox bring into question. And I'm assuming that there's more of an agrarian connection with the folks that you're all connected to. But this is I'm only saying this out of ignorance because I don't know much about your economy.
Thank you very much. We'll follow up with those questions. Larry, which one do you want to begin with?
We can start with the Holy Spirit, I guess.
Sure.
our confession of faith is Trinitarian. That is, the Holy Spirit is an important way that God expresses God's self in these days. Prayer is very important to us individually and also in our congregational life. We encourage people to come into the presence of God and to become aware of glimpses of grace all around us. But that includes also more intentional prayers, as we sometimes define those. Stewardship of the earth is very important to us. You're right. The Mennonites have been very agrarian ever since they came to the United States, especially. The Amish probably are much more sensitive to that than Mennonites, although we have many Mennonite farmers in many places. But that's as the whole rural life in the United States changes, we have less of that. And so a number of our rural churches are struggling to find their means of existence because there's smaller farms and so on. But our particular congregation is connected, at least geographically, close to the university. And so I think we have one legitimate farmer in our congregation. And
quite a few professors.
And quite a few professors, who, a number of whom are in agronomy, but are not farming themselves. But we do talk about the environment and how important that is in terms of the overall call of God in our lives. And so any way we can encourage and support environmental concerns, we try to do that and see that as very much a Christian calling, not just a humanitarian calling, although sometimes those certainly are one and the same thing.
Let me follow up just on one of those parts of that caller's question. And for others, we can probably slip in another call or two before the end of the program. 333-9455 in Champaign, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. But on the Holy Spirit, the doctrine of the Trinity seems so strange to modern people today. I mean, even if they may be a theist, they may believe there may be some ultimate divinity somewhere. How do you make sense of this notion of the Holy Spirit? And
Boy, that's, as you well know, there's been volumes and volumes written on that over the centuries, and I'm certainly not going to claim that I have that all figured out. I don't see the Trinity specifically defined and elaborated on in the New Testament, but because of the way Jesus was referred to and as the Holy Spirit was referred to and as God the Creator was referred to, there had to be some way of trying to tie this together and still say we believe in one God.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways our from my perspective, the human terminology of the Trinity or the Trinitarian God is kind of our human way of trying to explain this holy mystery of God that has expressed God's self in so many ways. And so for me, the Jesus is very important to me, but the ongoing presence of God that I become aware of is the Holy Spirit. That's God's presence with us now. But sometimes we talk about the living Christ being among us or God being among us. And I think even the New Testament, there was an awful lot of interchange and slipperiness about how you referred to what God's doing in our lives and what's happening in our lives. And so, yes, theologically we say we're Trinitarian. How to explain that or define that, I'm probably as much a loss as anybody. I mean, that's a hard question.
We have another either hard or easy question now on line one. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, I'm calling from Champaign, and Pastor Larry began setting out the foundation of Mennonite life with regards to the Sermon on the Mount and how that sets the tone of how they are or are not involved with peace issues and military issues. I guess I'd like to hear if that same Sermon on the Mount is used in for social concerns, and if Mennonites are at all involved, do they get concerned and insert themselves into these kinds of issues in the same way that they do around peace issues? And how could what are some examples of those? So I'll just hang up to listen. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Yeah, I think Mennonites do try to apply that in social kinds of ways. How we live collectively influences how we behave individually, to be sure. And it doesn't necessarily help me. It might help me personally and help another individual to offer a cup of cold water or to help do some of those individual kind of things. But if there's a system involved that is crushing that person, then somehow one needs to keep addressing that too. And so I think the social justice factor is important. I think, in fact, Mennonites today are saying that it's very naive to talk about peace unless you also talk about justice, and those are very much tied together. And being the quiet of the land for 200 or 300 years here in the States, it's been hard for us to move to talk much about justice. We'd rather talk about peace and harmony and get along with everybody. But I think there is more and more a strong element in the Mennonite church speaking about social justice issues. One way that we do that in terms of worldwide relief and development, the Arthur Mennonite Relief Sale just occurred Friday night and Saturday, and that's one of numerous relief sales around the United States and Canada. And hundreds of thousands of dollars are raised by these sales, but it's used in primarily to bring relief and also help developing new ways of people sustaining their own lives in ways that might be helpful. So that would be one example. We do have a peace office in Washington, D.C., where people come alongside and try to help raise. For example, if there are workers coming from various parts of the world who have done service for 2 or 3 years, they try to get an audience with representatives from the legislation and Congress, at least their aides, and say, this is what we're seeing, this is how we experience life there. Because sometimes that's not what makes the news. And if you have a congressional delegate go to a given country, you're going to have a whole different impression than if you actually have service people who are out working with the poor in those given countries. And so we try to provide another window to that. And hopefully that is another form of patriotism, but also social justice, of providing more information that maybe is not what maybe the reigning government of that given country necessarily wants the United States to be aware of.
And your local congregation, I know, recently responded very positively to requests from local students and others from Bangladesh in terms of the flood relief.
Mm-hmm. We got a call from the Bangladesh Student Association here on campus, and a number of those folks were also, of course, associated with the mosque. And being neighbors, we've been trying to find ways that we can work cooperatively with the Muslim constituency that they have. And so we invited two of these students to come and share on a Sunday morning a couple weeks ago. And they came and did a very excellent job of saying what the need was in the flooding that was going on in Bangladesh, but also that was the time when it was also with India and Nepal as well. And so because our Mennonite denomination, we have the relief organization called MCC, or Mennonite Central Committee, which does millions of dollars of relief around the world year in and year out. We have a program in Bangladesh doing flood stuff. And so we said, you can come, but probably not all the money that would be donated will come just to the Bangladesh Student Association, because they were going to channel it through Red Cross. And Red Cross is a reputable organization. But I think that Sunday morning at the end of the service, when they present their call, and we counted on the fact that we wanted to have another way of saying this is the Christian Church working with Muslims at their request. Mm-hmm. There was some $370-some raised for the Red Cross via the student organization.
From a pretty small congregation.
We have 115 to 150 mm-hmm. people on a Sunday morning. Yeah. And then there was $500-some for Bangladesh flooding in for MCC. So it was $800 that was kind of above our general offering, which people didn't really know about ahead of time.
Sure.
And so that felt really good to me. And I hope, and from what I gathered from the students, they felt very positive about that too. And it wasn't the dollar amount, but I think it was the fact that we wanted to try to work in cooperation with them.
We have another caller waiting on line one. You're on the air with Pastor Larry Wilson.
Hi. I'd like to follow up on the question regarding land stewardship. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering specifically as the sustainable agricultural ways that the Amish practice, if you could elaborate a little bit more on the scriptural basis for those. Thank you.
The scriptural basis of conservation and stewardship kind of things.
And sustainable agriculture.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Let me give you an example that when I was pastoring in Ohio, we lived in an Amish Mennonite community that was much more highly concentrated than it is around here. And I used to jog when I was younger. And when I was jogging down this one road, I remember coming across a field where there was an Amish farmer with six or seven horses and a number of children that were helping do things. And he was working, and he'd go down at the end of the row and would stop and let his horses rest. In the adjacent field was a huge tractor that had a tremendously a large disc that he was plowing the field with. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder at the end of the year, which one has actually been more respectful of the land? The horse did not require the gasoline. It was not an $80,000 machine. There was just all kinds of ways that the other farmer would need many, many more acres to farm, and that was been 15 years ago. And so I know that farmers have a hard time making it and without large quantities of acres. But I think biblically, I think if one treats the land with respect as being part of God's creation, just like you treat life, there is life in the earth in the sense of one tries to respect that. I don't know whether all the Amish do that well. I don't know whether all Mennonites do that well. Everybody struggles to make a living. But I think it's something that we all need to be paying attention to, not only in terms of land, but also in terms of water and air, because that's our lifeline, if you will, to ongoing life and existence. And I think God cares about that because God cares about us.
Let me follow up on an issue I raised earlier, the whole issue of suffering. And the Mennonites and Amish have been discriminated against in several countries, mm-hmm. in Europe and in the Americas as well. Mm-hmm. How do you interpret that? Some people just see, hey, this is a strange way of life. Hey, these people aren't, they're different.
They're different, yeah. There's been some interesting conversations going on in the last 10 years between Mennonites and a special group from the Roman Catholics, as well as with the Lutherans and also the Reformed Church, where there's some pretty high-level conversations taking place of trying to find ways of what happened back in the 1500s. And there's been some reconciliation and some good things happening in a number of places, particularly in Europe, but there's also some things happening here in the States. And so I think that the worlds are different now than they were. Lutherans and the Reformed Church and also the Catholic Church, there's a lot more cooperation and understanding. And whenever we're threatened, we tend to react and fight back in some ways. And I think that was happening in some of those churches that were state churches, and it was a difficult time. And I don't think that any of those denominations or churches now are all that proud of what happened. But what is one? It's history, so you can't go back and undo it. As I look back at some of the early Anabaptists, too, I would think maybe they could have waited a little longer. They were kind of radical at the time. You know, would something have changed? But maybe it took those radical kinds of ways to make a statement until it did kind of break things loose and things did change, including the churches they were breaking away from.
When the Mennonites and the Amish and others in the Anabaptist movement said to the other reformers who were breaking away from the Catholic Church at the time, hey, you haven't gone far enough. Mm-hmm. You haven't really reformed the church. Was there any self-righteousness in that? Do you get any tinges of that as you read read some of your history?
Yeah. I'm sure there's always some self-righteous things in it. I would like to say there's not, but I think that there's a lot of reminders that we all have to keep giving to each other that we don't have a corner on truth. Granted, when they were saying that the reformers had not gone far enough, it's not unlike what the reformers felt like. You know, were they feeling self-righteous that they had gone farther than the Catholic Church had at that point? The human nature is a difficult thing to deal with, and pride and trying to work that through is hard. And I guess that's why I think it's, from a Christian point of view, why I think it's so important to say we all need forgiveness. We all need a Savior, if you will, using very Christian kind of terms. But not just to use that as an excuse, because there are things that God continues to call us toward, and that's very, very important.
I want to thank our guest today, Pastor Larry Wilson from the First Mennonite Church of Urbana on the corner of Lincoln and Springfield. And I want to thank our callers who've came up with such good questions and comments for our guest today. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this Keeping the Faith program, which is heard every Sunday from 5 to 6 Central Time here on WILL AM 580. Our guest next week will be Don Mason, talking about his experience in Africa recently at the World Alliance of Reformed Churches. And September 12, our guest will be Mary Joy Carnate and Claire Delahunt, talking about the Vis-a-Vis Volunteer Tutoring Program. I want to thank our listeners again, and thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Anderson Foundation, AgriFab Incorporated, Sullivan, Jarman Center, Tuscola, and Reap Farms Limited, Melvin. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Another wonderful conversation I overheard in the same mirror maze was a husband and wife. One of them said, "Are you coming or going?" And the other one said, "Yes, yes."
Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll look at the history of mirrors as we reflect on the question, how do you know who you are? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, offering beginner-level instruction in Iyengar Yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, healthy heart, plus size, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start after Labor Day. Information at 344-YOGA or on the web at yoga-cu.com.